quick administrative things. I'll introduce the officers. We have Matt Garcia is the webmaster. So you can find the website at ma.utexas.edu/matt. Kyle Knopf, the videographer. We got the videos uploaded. And Nicole Jensen is our events coordinator. And Nicholas Marino is not here, I believe. And he's the one who makes the flyers. And if you want to be on the mailing list, I'm going to hand this around and put your email address on it. And our speaker today is Dr. Starbird. He has asked me to put in a plug for his book, Five Elements of Effective Thinking. It's a very good book, so you should get it. And so, welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here to tell you about all sorts of things. One of the terms in the title was calculus. So the first thing I want to do is teach you calculus. So I'm going to do that in, and I know I don't have much time here, so I'm going to do that in 4 minutes, teach you all of calculus, not just some of it. And so here we go. Suppose that you have a car moving on a straight road, and you're in a car and you're driving along, and the straight road has it's very well marked with mileage markers. In fact, it's got a mileage marker at every single point on the road, which is pretty good, you know. And you're driving along in the car, and you want to make sure that your speed is okay, but you don't have a speedometer. Or at least you don't look at it, and so you don't have the speedometer, but you can see where you are at every instant, and so you want to decide, well, how fast are you going at each instant? And you know, because you can look out the window, that at every time t naught, you're at a certain location, p of t naught. And if you want to know how fast you're going right at one instant, well, at one instant, you're not going anywhere, right? You're just at one spot. This is the old paradox of Zeno. You're not going anywhere. So what are you going to do to say how fast you're going at an instant? Well, you say, well, where am I a little beyond that instant? You know, so you look at your watch, and a little beyond the instant, you say, where were you at that instant? And if you divide by the elapsed time, that gives you the average speed that you went in that very short amount of time. And if you just think about sampling at different h's, small h's, then you would get the exact answer in the limit. And so this is the velocity or the derivative at time t. But now suppose that you were on the alternative. Suppose that you were a avant-garde movie maker, you see, and you wanted to make a really boring movie, because that's what you do if you're avant-garde. You know, you want to make it really boring. And so what you do is you are inside the same car, but what you do is you just take a camera and you just watch the speedometer. Now we're back to having a speedometer, by the way. So you're just watching the speedometer, and all you do is you take the picture of that speedometer, and it just sits there. You know. And an hour passes, and then you say, oh, well, geez, I wonder how far I've gone. Well, if the movie is really boring and the speedometer doesn't move at all, then you know how far you've gone, right? Right?
Right.
Yeah, right, right. What would it be if the speedometer just stayed at one spot for the whole hour? How far would you have gone?
That rate times time,
so it's that rate. If it's the exact same thing for the whole hour, then you know how to figure out how far you've gone. Now suppose that the speedometer actually varied a little bit. So maybe for the first half hour it was at one speed, and then at the next half hour it zoomed up to another speed without any transition. Would you know how to compute how far you've gone? Yeah, you just divide the time. And if in fact your speed varied, what you could do is just divide the time into little tiny pieces, see how far you went in every little tiny interval of time, take the interval of time times the distance, and that would give you how far you've gone. So there's another way to compute the distance traveled. And by the way, that is the integral of the speed, would if you started at time t and went to started at time a and you went to time b, that adding up process of little pieces would be the distance traveled, right? Okay, and we call that the integral, that adding up little pieces. And by the way, if you notice, if you had one person who's driving the car and all he's doing is looking out the side of the window, and you have the other person taking this avant-garde movie, and you said, geez, how far did we go between time A and time B? Right? Well, one person says, well, that's easy. I just look out the window and see where I was at time B, and I subtract where I was at time A, and that gives me the distance traveled. But it's also true that that is equal to this integral process from A to B of adding up little pieces of what the speedometer is reading, but the speedometer is reading the derivative, remember, because that was the speed. And therefore, we see that those two numbers must give you the same thing, how far that car went during that hour. And so that's the fundamental theorem of calculus. So we've seen the definition of the derivative, the definition of the integral, and the fundamental theorem of calculus, and we're done with calculus, and I did it within the 4 minutes that I told you I was. Okay. Now you need to know these things for the future, so I'm gonna start by asking you some questions. And the first question is this. Suppose that you take a circle. Here's a circle. Can you see that? Not very well, but you can. Okay, there's a circle. And suppose that you decide to look at it more closely. And so you just magnify in at a little part of the circle. Well, I've drawn that, and you probably can't see it either, but here we go. Here we go. You see, you get closer to the circle. Okay, by just magnifying, you're getting closer, you put your eye closer and closer. And then, on your graphing calculator, the computer, you can just say, expand. Okay. Now suppose that we do the same thing again, and you get even closer, like this. Now suppose that we just keep doing that magnification process for a lot of times, like millions of times. What's it going to look like after you multiply it, millions of times? No, it's going to look like this piece of paper, you see, magnified a million times, because that's... Okay, just a little joke. Yeah, you're exactly right. The correct picture of a circle magnified a lot is just a straight line. In fact, that's true for any differentiable function. It's a way to take something that's curved, but if you look at it close enough, it just looks like a straight line. That's really what it means to be differentiable. Okay, now... Okay, in particular, a circle has that property. In fact, we live on a big sphere, which is sort of like a big, circle. And it looks flat, and if you just look locally, whereas actually it's round. And so we're going to use that insight in order to do a little bit of calculus. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you to take the derivative of the sine function. So this is the derivative of the sine function. And so here we go. Let me see if we can take the derivative of the sine. So remember what the derivative is. The derivative of any function is the value of the function plus a little bit minus the value of the function over the change. Okay? And so let's try that for the sine function and see what the derivative of the sine is. Now I know you all say, I know what the derivative of the sine is, but you don't know why. Right? That's right. Thank you, Nicole. Thank you. I appreciate a little response here from the audience. Okay, so let's just see why the derivative of the sine is what it is. So here we go. Now, remember that this is the unit circle. So this is length 1. This is length 1 here. The radius of this circle is 1. And this is an angle x here. And the sine of x is this height right here. You agree? That's the definition of the sine of x, so you don't have to agree, I'm just telling you. So there's the sine of x. And here we take a little bit more of an angle h here, and we want to think about the difference between the height that we would go from here. This point has height sine of x plus h. Do you agree? This point, because this is x plus angle h, a small angle h, so this height from here all the way down has length sine of x plus h. You agree? And this length is sine x, so if we just stopped right here at that level, we would see that this length right here is the sine of x plus h minus the sine of x. Do you all agree? Okay. Now, what about this length here? What is the length of that part of that circle? And by the way, what's the shape of that? It's a straight line, right? That's what we talked about already. It's just a straight line. And how long is that line? Okay, on the count of three, I want everybody to tell me the length of that little segment. Okay, ready? One, two, three.
H.
H is correct. Okay, and that is, by the way, why we measure angles in radians, so that the length of that straight line is actually equal to the measure of the angle. That's why we use radian measure for the angle. See? Okay, now, so that length is h, and this is sine of x plus h minus sine of x. And once we see that, we can't resist realizing that the derivative of the sine is just the fraction of this over this, right? So we just write that down. The sine of x plus h minus the sine of x over h. We can't resist that because it looks like the derivative of the sine, which we're after. So now we say, whoa, is that equal to something? Is it possible that's equal to something? If it were, that would be helpful because then we'd know what the derivative is. Well, let's see. Now, by the way, this is a right triangle. Do you notice that? And this is a right triangle here. Right? Now, do you see any angles that are equal? Well, here's an angle x. Do you see any other angle that's equal to x? So this is ancient geometry. You can do it with your hands, by the way. You do it with your hands. You know, go, come on, use your hands. Get your hands up. What angle is equal to x?
The lower thing.
Yeah. There you go. That's right. That's right, because look, you've got two parallel lines, and you've got a transversal, so the opposite interior angles are the same. So that's angle x. And by the way, you know, if you take the radius of a circle and you look at the angle between it and a tangent line to the circle, you know what that is? Yes, you do. 90 degrees. Right? That's 90 degrees. And so that means that this angle here is, this whole thing is 90 degrees, and this is x, so this is x minus 90, which means that this angle up here is x. You see that? Everybody agree? Okay? Now look, oh, that means we have a right triangle with an angle x and another right triangle with an angle x. So these are similar triangles. So that means that if we take, this is the side next to the angle x in this right triangle divided by its hypotenuse. So then this is a similar triangle. So the ratio of the side next to the angle x, well, what is that? Cosine of x is this distance from here to here. You see? And what is the radius, the hypotenuse? One. And so that means that the derivative of the sine, by the way, the reason that we have to take a limit is because since that's slightly curved, it's not exactly equal to h, you see? But as you get smaller and smaller, it becomes really h. Thank you. And therefore, we see that the derivative of the sine of x is equal to the cosine of x. Is that pretty cool?
Yeah.
Pretty cool. How many of you had calculus and you knew the derivative of the sine? Do you remember how it was proved in the book? No idea. Well, it wasn't this way, and I was very proud of this. I figured this out myself, and I thought, geez, you know, it's funny that they don't put that in the calculus books. Why don't they put, Dave, why don't they put that in the calculus books?
Because they want people to enjoy the algebra of...
The algebra of, and trigonometry. They learned all that trigonometry, sums of angles and stuff. They should use it. Exactly, exactly. To obfuscate the obvious. But I was very proud of this, and I gave this at a talk once, and I said, well, does anybody else do this? And there was one audience of mathematicians, and there was one guy who did it this way. Jeff Weeks, and he said, yeah, he's a famous guy. He did it, and then he told me afterwards that neither he nor I were the first ones to think of it. It was actually thought of by Leibniz. So not the first ones, but okay, you can't have everything. So we were scooped by Leibniz, but that's not a bad person to be scooped by. So anyway, this is the derivative of the sine is equal to the cosine. That's pretty cool, right? And you can do, by the way, for yourselves at home, you can go home and do the derivative of the cosine in the same way. Now, we did the derivative of the sine. Let's do the integral of the sine. Okay, the integral of the sine from 0 to pi over 2. The integral of sine x dx from 0 to pi over 2. Now, I know you're all saying you know how to do this. Right? How do you do it? First of all, do you know what the answer is? Take a minute, talk to your neighbor if you need to. Talk to your neighbor, and what is the answer? What is the answer? Oh, sorry. Yeah, I'll move it up. What is the answer of the integral of the sine? Okay, come on. Right. Okay, so the answer is, okay, on the count of three, what is the answer?
One.
Answer.
Two, three.
What is the answer on the count of three? One, two, three?
One.
And how did you do it? Be honest, how did you do it?
Cosine 0 minus cosine pi over 2.
That's right. What you did is you took the antiderivative of the sine, which is the cosine, and you plugged in pi over 2, and you plugged in 0. Cosine of pi over 2 is 1, and then 0, 0, and therefore you got it using the fundamental theorem of calculus. That's the way you did it, right? Admit it. Admit it. Okay, which is fine, except that I want to do it directly. I want to know, I remember what the definition of the integral is. The integral is adding up a bunch of little pieces, right? The sine x times a little h, and then a sine x times another h as x varies between angle 0 and angle pi over 2. So let's just go ahead and add those up and see what the integral really is as a sum. So here we go. What we're going to do is we're going to divide the angles between 0 and pi over 2 into little pieces, and this is one of the little pieces, h. Now we're going to be taking the integral of the sine. The sine is this height here. This is sine x here, remember. And the definition of the integral is adding up sine x for every angle x times a little increment of between x and a little bit more than x. And so I'm interested in knowing what's going to happen when I take a little angle h here. And I consider the product of h times sine of x. And I want to know what I get. Well, let's see. First of all, I look at this picture, and I want to see what is the width of this little segment right here. What's the width of that little segment? Do you know? All right. No, but just by definition, this is the point here is sine x, cosine x, comma sine x, and this point it has two coordinates. What are its two coordinates? Well, cosine x plus h, and sine x plus h. So what is this width here? The width.
Cosine x plus h minus cosine.
Well, it's actually cosine of x, since that's the bigger one, minus the cosine of x plus h. Okay? So that's this length right here. Okay? Okay, so that's the width here. Now, I'm really interested in, you know, I know something about the about this triangle compared to this triangle, because we saw it last time. What is it?
They're similar.
They're similar, right? They're similar. So this time, remember, I have this angle x up here again, and I now know this width. So I know that this width over h. So this is, I'll put it down here, cosine x minus cosine x plus h divided by the hypotenuse of that triangle, this h, is going to be the side opposite the angle x, which is what length? Sine of x divided by the hypotenuse of this big triangle, which is what? One. Now, if we cross multiply, we get that 1 times cosine of x minus the cosine of x plus h is equal to h times the sine of x. Now, the integral is just taking these h times the sines of x and going all the way as x varies between 0 and pi over 2. But for every little increment of angle that I'm measuring by x, notice that the product of h times the sine of x, h times the sine of x, is exactly equal to 1, which is the height of this rectangle. See, the height of that rectangle is 1, times its width, cosine of x minus cosine of x plus h. And therefore, when I add up these h times sine of x's as x varies between 0 and pi over 2, I just get the sum of the areas of these rectangles. But these rectangles are filling up just the width between here and here. So I just fill up this square that's height is 1 and its width is 1. So therefore, the integral is equal to 1. Because I just fill up this square with rectangles. And therefore, the area of that square is equal to the integral. So that's why the integral of the sine is from 0 to pi over 2 is equal to 1. Cool?
Is that the magical part?
Very cool. No. Okay. So now, let's see. Okay, here we go. So this is, but it is pretty magical, isn't it? It is pretty, by the way, you know, all of these things work out in math. If you actually just say, what is the definition of things, and you follow it through, they always are going to work, because it's true. You know, it's true. Okay, anyway, this is very cool. So now this is another thing. Very cool. So that's the derivative of the sine, derivative of the cosine. Now, I wanted to show you something else. So here we go. I wanted to show you what happens when you take the... I'll do this next here. So, I'll do this next. Okay, we'll do a slight change in thing. Suppose that you have a triangle here, and you have its base here, and you have its height. Then you know that the area of this triangle is equal to the half of the base times the height, because it's half of a rectangle. Okay? Okay, so, but how about if your triangle, instead of being a right triangle, suppose that it's a wrong triangle? Or no, I mean a... Not wrong. There are no wrong triangles. That was a joke. Suppose that it's a triangle where the top is a different place, you see. Why is it that the area of this triangle is still the same thing?
Still half the parallelogram.
Well, it's half of the parallelogram, but then why is the parallelogram equal to the base times the height? Yeah, that's right. But suppose you didn't know that. See, these people who know too much, it's just annoying. Instead, what I'm suggesting is this, that you could always, suppose that you have any triangle whose height is the same, you know, as something. What's the length of, for example, the piece that's exactly halfway between the base and the height? What's its width?
Half of the base.
Half of the base, because it's a similar triangle. So the thing is halfway is half, a third of the way is a third, three quarters of the way is three quarters. And so, but suppose that you move the top way over here, and you did the same thing. You had a triangle whose base is identical, but whose height is also identical, but its peak is over here. How wide would the edge be in the middle? Still be exactly half. And so if you wanted to fill up this triangle by just little widths of these blocks, you would still fill it up exactly. If you moved it over, those blocks would just slide over. And by the way, I used to have one of these things where I could literally slide it over and all the pieces just slid over and it would fill up the other triangle. It was very cool, but I broke it. Okay, so... Anyway, so this is a principle about area, and by the way, it works equally well for three-dimensional shapes. So for example, if you have a tetrahedron. See, a tetrahedron, if you have a tetrahedron, these are supposed to be two tetrahedra, but each with the same identical base, but the apex point is at the same height, like the base is on this table, and the apex point is above the table, and you just move it at the same height, but at a different place, to get a tetrahedron that's sort of skew. And I'm claiming that the volume of those two tetrahedra would be exactly the same. Because for the same reasoning, if you look at a point that's sort of halfway above, the triangle that's at that cross-section would be exactly the same shape, except just half as big. Right? No matter if you moved it way over here or had the apex up here, if the base is the same, you're going to get the same volume. Do you agree with that? You see what I mean? So the volume of a tetrahedron is going to be associated with the base times the height, something about that, but it doesn't matter where the height is. Okay? Do you all agree? I used to have one of these too, that really broke. Come here, you can come to my office. Yeah. Anyway, so but we want to do that to see what is the volume of a tetrahedron. You know, what's the volume of a tetrahedron? How are we going to figure out the volume of a tetrahedron? Well, here's the way we're going to do it. We're going to look at a prism. So this is a prism, like you look through the light and it changes all the colors. So it's a prism. It's a triangle, and then it just goes straight up, and that's a prism. And here is the prism. And in the prism, I can actually make that prism into three tetrahedra. And here they are. This red one is the top, and then we just cone down to this bottom corner. Do you see that red one? So it's an upside down where the peak of it is down. Tetrahedra. Now we have a similar one. This white one has the base, and then you cone up to the top. So it's just symmetrical, right? So those are two tetrahedra that make up this pyramid. And then there's a third piece, and that's this blue thing here. The blue thing is the rest of it. Well, the blue thing is also a tetrahedron. It's a little bit harder to see it in your mind's eye, but maybe you can see it here. It's got one face that's on the white tetrahedra face. It's got one face that's half of this rectangular front face. It's got one face that's half of this rectangular face here. And then it's got another face slanting backwards that's part of this red face back here. Do you see it? A little hard to see, but it is a tetrahedron. And by the way, you can think of it this way. It's a tetrahedron where you see this triangular half of this side here. And then you're coning over to this point up here. You see that? The thing about a tetrahedron, you know what a tetrahedron is? It's a triangle, and then you pick a point. And then sort of, it's all the lines that go between that triangle and that point. But if you check any of the other faces of a tetrahedron, and you go to the opposite point vertex, it's also, you know, any of the four vertices can be considered the point. Right? So now look at this. Look at this. Look at this. Look at this red tetrahedron. We thought of the base as being the height and the peak being down here. But now let's just look at that same red tetrahedron a little bit differently, with this being the base, this half of the rectangle, and then the cone point being over here. You see that? But now compare that figure with the blue tetrahedron. It's just the other half of this same rectangle coned to the same point. So that means that the red tetrahedron and the blue tetrahedra, those are also the same volume. You see? Because they both have the same size base and the same height. So they're the same volume. So now we have all three of these tetrahedra have exactly the same volume. Because the red one and the white one clearly have the same volume. They have the same area base, the same height. And now we saw that the red and the blue one are the same volume. So therefore, the volume of a tetrahedron is exactly one-third of the volume of a prism. But the volume of a prism is easy. It's just the area of the base times the height. So we have a formula. The formula for the volume of a prism is one-third base times height. I mean the volume of a tetrahedron is one-third the area of the base times the height. So this is pretty cool. Do you see that, you think? Okay. By the way, you have to explain this to several people before you really get it, because that's a little hard to visualize, and I understand that it's hard to visualize. Now let's look at the area of a cone. So here's a cone. If we wanted to know, well, what's the volume of a cone? Well, it's easy, because if you have a cone here, you could think about just filling up the base by triangles. And you might have to have infinitely many as you get near the edge. But you know what the volume of each of those tetrahedra are. It's just the area of the base times the height. And if you have like two just triangles next to each other, what's the volume of the figure that encompasses both of those bases times the height? Well, it's just one-third the area of the combined bases times the same height. So you just combine it, even if it's infinitely many. And so we see that the volume of a cone is also one-third the area of the base times the height. And by the way, you also see that that's true for any figure. It doesn't even have to be a cone. It could just be any area in the plane. And then you pick a point up on top and draw all the straight lines to it. The volume of that figure is going to be one-third the area of the base times the height. Okay? So that's the volume of a cone or a tetrahedron. It's great. It's great. These things are great. Now, what I want to do now is to show you what the surface area of a sphere is. The surface area of a sphere. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a sphere. And suppose I ask you the following question. I said, you're living on the Earth, okay? And I'm going to give you a choice. Here's a choice. I'm going to let you have all of the area of the Earth between two parallel planes. Think of them like between two latitudes, okay? And so you have all of the Earth between these two latitudes, everything between latitude 20 degrees and 21 degrees. Would you rather have that area of the Earth, or would you rather have all of the area of the Earth between the same height distance at some other place, like near the North Pole or near the equator? You know, the height is the same, but you just cut the Earth at different places. Where are you going to get more area? Do you think you're going to get it right at the middle? Or how about way at the very top where you actually get the whole polar cap down to a certain thing? Where do you think you're going to get the most area? Talk it over with the person next to you and make a decision. Say, equator, polar cap, somewhere in between. Okay, talk it over. Talk it over. What? The middle?
I would want like slightly above the
equator. Slightly above the equator?
Oh, no. I mean, we're talking about
location. Oh, location.
I think
there
we go.
We're trained
here.
All right. Okay, so on the count of three, tell me You advocate for your position, so say either equator, polar cap, in between. On the count of three, one, two, three. That is anemic. That is really pathetic. You've got to be more assertive. Okay, so how many people said near the equator is the most? How many people say near the polar cap, the actual polar cap, is the most? How many say in between is the most? How many say other? Okay, yeah, other wins. Now, here we go. So let me just say, what it turns out that if you have a little band here, the area of the Earth between these two heights is exactly equal to the area of this belt that would go around a cylinder that exactly encased the Earth. Isn't that amazing? So it doesn't matter if you take between two things that are 1 mile apart in the middle, the area is just the area of that belt. Or if it's down near the bottom, it's the area of the belt. It's always the area of the belt, so it's always the same. It doesn't matter where it is, you see? So that's very cool. Well, it's very cool if you're near the North Pole. Okay, so here we go. Here's what we want to show. Suppose that we're up at a height in the sphere of radius r, but we're up at a height where the radius of that part is just s, and we want to know how to compare the area of this sort of slanted, you see, it's a sort of a slanted thing compared to the vertical belt. You see, since it's slanted, there's more area as you go around, but it's smaller. And it turns out those two things exactly cancel out. Let's see why. So here we go. This is. All right, so here we go. Let's just look at this picture. And once again, we will find that it's our old friend that shows us the way here. Let me see here if I can... sort of lost my way here. I'll just draw it. Okay, so here we go. I'm going to look at a cross section. So here is the sphere. Here is a little part here. And this is the vertical line here. And let's suppose that this height here is h for height. And now look at this. If this is, once again, if we go out to, this is the radius r, and this is width s, and we're trying to compare s times this sort of slanty height times this times r. You see, because it's really 2 pi times s times this is going to be the area of that slanty circular thing. And then h, this height, times 2 pi r is going to give you the area of that vertical belt. Okay? So let's see if we can compare those. So this, if we call this thing here, so this is h. And this one here is, what shall we call this? T? Okay, and so we're trying to compare two pi r times h, and we're trying to compare it to 2 pi s times t. Those are the two things we're trying to compare. Do you see why? Because 2 pi r h is equal to the area of this belt going around, and 2 pi s times t is going to be the area of that slanted belt going around. Okay? And so now let's just see what we know. Well, once again, since by similar triangles, as always, we know that, first of all, this angle x is equal to, well, let's see if this is angle y, this is angle y, this is angle x here. Okay? And so we have that h over t is equal to, that's the opposite to angle x, the opposite to angle x is s over t is the radius, so this, I mean the hypotenuse, so this is the hypotenuse r. So this implies that h times r is equal to s times t. And then if we multiply both sides by 2 pi, we have what we want. So it's our old similar triangles once again come to the rescue to show us that that vertical belt is exactly equal in area to the tilted belt that we would get if we took that slab of the Earth. And consequently, if we did this for the slabs all the way up and down the sphere, boom, 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 what are we going to deduce is the area, surface area, of the entire Earth? The lateral surface area of the cylinder. And what is that?
Circumference times height.
And what is the circumference? If the radius is r, what is the circumference?
2 pi r.
And what's the height?
2r.
So then that shows us that the area of the surface of a sphere equals the circumference, 2 pi r, times the height, 2r, which is equal to 4 pi r squared. So that's the surface area of the sphere. Pretty cool. Pretty cool, right? So now the reason, one of the, I mean, that's cool in itself, of course, but what's another thing that's cool about it is that now we're in a position to find the formula for the volume of a sphere. How would we do that? You may wonder. How are you going to find the volume of the sphere? Knowing all that we know so far, how are you going to find the volume of the sphere? Well, look. We know the volume of, if we take a little piece of the sphere, and then we just cone down to the center, like if we have a triangular piece on the surface of the sphere and cone down, we know what that volume is. Right? It's the area of the base of that triangle times the height, but in this case the height is the radius. The radius. So that means that if we add up all of these, we just take the entire surface of the sphere and break it up into little tiny pieces, and each one we cone down to the center of the sphere, and we add up the volumes of all those little pieces, what are we going to get? We're going to get, So look. So the volume of the sphere is equal to, well, it's going to be the surface area, 4 pi r squared. And then how do we get the volume of something? It's 1/3, this is the area of the base, times the height. Because the height of each of those little things is equal to r. So this is equal to 4/3 pi r cubed. 4/3 pi r cubed. So this is a cool way to find the formula for the volume of a sphere. Right? Now, by the way, another thing you should think about is, what's the relationship between the volume of a sphere and the surface area? Yeah, because you see, if you had like an onion consists of a lot of thin layers that grow up, right? Thin layers. And you wanted to compute the volume of that sphere, what you could do is just add up all of those thin layers of onion, and that would give you the volume. But on the other hand, if you just stop at one piece, what is the contribution to the volume of one skin of the onion? Well, it's the surface area at that radius. So that's why the derivative of the volume as r is changing is exactly equal to the surface area. and which so that it's not a surprise that 4/3 pi r cubed, the derivative of that is 4 pi r squared, the surface area of the sphere. And by the way, I should say this is also true for much simpler things such as a square. What's the derivative? Suppose that this is x and this is x. And you're thinking about a square growing up, leaving this point fixed. This is the origin, and you're just picking larger and larger x's. And you say, oh, well, the area at each choice of x is x squared. What is the derivative? Well, the derivative is what you get by looking at a slightly bigger square and dividing, like if this is size h, additional, then you take this bigger amount and then you divide it by h, right? So you take this bigger square area minus the smaller square area, which is just these two bands. You divide by h, but this is basically a rectangle. In fact, this is exactly a rectangle of size h. So when you divide by h, you get just this length of this line. And when you divide this by h, you get the length of this line. And you get a little thing in here that's, you know, real small, you forget it. And so you get 2x. That's why the derivative of x squared is 2x, visually. And you can see the same thing for x cubed. You know, you have a cube, and the three sides of the cube are growing. So all of these things make sense. Okay, but now we've got... Yes, sir?
Just making sure, is 4 pi r squared the base because all of the bases of the triangle compose the surface area? Is that why you made 4 pi r squared like the base of the one third base?
That's correct. That because the totality of all those areas, if you filled up the entire sphere, is exactly 4 pi r squared. Right, good. Thanks. Okay. Okay, now for the concluding thing, I'm going to show you how Archimedes figured out the volume of a sphere. So this is a different method of figuring out the volume of a sphere, and it's a method that only Archimedes could possibly have thought of. In fact, he was so proud of this, he wanted to have it on his tombstone, this derivation of the volume of a sphere. And it really is neat because I don't know if you know about Archimedes, but Archimedes, first of all, is an amazing, amazing mathematician. But one thing that he's most famous for is the lever. You know the lever? And you know how a lever works, by the way? If you have a lever and you've got a big kid and a small kid, and you want them to balance on a fulcrum. So here's a big kid, and here's a small kid. Cute, I know. When will they balance?
Distance times mass equals other distance times mass.
Exactly. Where this distance, the distance where this big kid is, times that big kid's mass, is equal to the distance to the small kid times the little kid's weight. And if those two products are the same, then they balance. Okay? Now, Archimedes was famous for this, and what's amazing is that he's going to use this fact about balancing fulcrums to compute the volume of a sphere. And this is sort of amazing. Can you imagine such a thing? Okay, so here we go. Okay, we're going to try this, and we'll see if it works. This is going to require some concentration. So are you strong? Are you mentally strong?
No.
Come on, you got to be. So you got to really try for the next. It's going to take about 7 minutes. Okay. So you've got to really concentrate for 7 minutes. Are you willing to do that? Everybody on board? Okay. So it's a new handhold. We're starting from scratch, but you got to really concentrate. So the goal here is to compute a formula for the volume of a sphere of radius r. That's what the goal is. And what he does, and by the way, you know, there are some things, I don't believe that I really understand a mathematical idea until I have convinced myself of why the person who thought of it thought of it. You know, why was this a natural thing to think of? To me, that's when you really understand something, where you say, oh yeah, that's what I would have thought of if I had just thought of it. And this is not in that category. So this is too clever. Okay, so here we go. So here's what he did. So we're going to start with this picture, and this picture consists of three objects that are all on top of each other. Oh, Maggie, you came just in time. So I'm talking about the volume. This is Archimedes' argument for the formula for the volume of a sphere. And we're starting from scratch. Alec, we're starting from scratch, but everybody has to really think, okay? Are you on board, Maggie? Come on, here we go. So he starts out with this thing. He starts out with three objects. One is the sphere that he is trying to compute the volume of. That's what he does not know. And it, you can sort of see it. It's a blue thing here. It has radius r. And then right in the same place, he puts a cone whose vertex is here, and the cone goes straight out to have size its radius is 2r. You see, its radius is 2r. And then in the same place, he also puts a cylinder whose height is 2r. It's a cylinder like this, you see. Its height is 2r, and its radius is 2r. So it's sort of a squat cylinder. Height 2r, radius 2r, okay? And all of these are fitting together, and the sphere just fits in there because it's r plus r in width, so it's 2r. Okay, so we have a cone going through, and notice that the cone, its cone point is here at the zero, and the cone would go right through the equator. You see that? How the cone, it's getting bigger, and it would go through the equator at point R, and then it carries on to the top of the cylinder. So you've got this cylinder with a cone inside, sort of going from the base of the cylinder here and coming down to a point at the center of the other side of the cylinder, right? Cylinder like this. And then you got the sphere in there, okay? So you got to, can you picture those things? Okay. Now what he's going to do, and this is sort of, this is very cool. What he's going to do is he's going to take a slice right at a point X here, X distance away from the origin. He's going to take a slice that goes through all three of those objects. It's going to create three slices, a slice of the cylinder, a slice of the cone, and a slice of the sphere. Okay? Three disks. And they're, of course, all on top of each other at this point, but we're going to soon move them so they're not on top of each other. But right now, they're all on top of each other. They're all located at some point X there. Okay, now what we're going to do is we're going to move these. Here they are. Here's a picture of them. The big one is the cylinder. The littler one here is the part of the cone. And the small one here is the part of the sphere. You see that? Those are disks, three disks, okay? Now what we're going to do now is he's going to now use this fulcrum idea. He's going to hang this disk that's of the big cylinder. He's going to leave it exactly where it is, at this point, X distance away from the origin. But he's going to take those two other disks, the disk that came from the sphere and the disk that came from the cone, and he's going to move both of those and hang them from the point that's exactly 2r away on the other side. So this one is at x. These two disks are both hung from the point 2r. And he claims that if you just did that, if you sliced those three objects and balance them in those ways, they would exactly balance. They would exactly balance. Let's see why. So we've got to look at a little bit of... The blue one's a sphere. The red one is the cone. And the other one is this. Now, let's just see why they balance. So here comes a little bit of algebra to see why, a little geometry to see why they balance. So let's just look at the point that's distance x away from the origin here. And remember that all three of these objects, the sphere, the cone coming up like this, and then the cylinder, which would go all the way to the top, are all on top of each other here. And I want to know, how high is... Okay, so we're moving these over That is, these meaning the part of the sphere whose height is y, plus the part of the cone. By the way, what is the part of the cone? What's the radius of that disk? If we're x distance away here. It's x, right. Because that cone is going from point size 0 to size 2r in distance 2r. So it's just this distance from here straight down to here is x. So that means that the area of the cone part is x radius times pi x squared is its area, right? Pi x squared would be the area of the disk in the cylinder. Pi y squared would be the area of the disk from the sphere. But what's y in relation to x and r? Well, we just draw this little picture. Y is the height of that part of the sphere. And if we look at this picture, this is r, the radius of the sphere. If this distance is x, then this distance is x minus r. And therefore, by the Pythagorean theorem, this length here, y, is the square root of r squared minus x minus r squared. And if we do that algebra, we get that, and then by the way, we're taking pi y squared, so we're squaring y, so that means it's the area of that disk is pi times the square root of 2x r minus x squared, that which is, by the way, the square root of r squared minus x minus r all squared. That's this height by the Pythagorean theorem. Okay? And then this is the area of that disk. This. Pi times that radius squared. Okay? This, pi x squared, is the radius of the disk from the cone. Okay? So we've got these two areas, and we're balancing them, we're putting them over 2r away to the left of that zero mark. So this is why we're hanging this disk and this other disk here at 2r. So we have 2r times the area of this disk plus the area of this bigger disk, and we're going to compare that to x, which is the distance away from the fulcrum here, times pi times 2r all squared, which is the radius of this entire cylinder. That's 2r squared, pi times its radius squared. So the question is, are these two things equal? Well, if we just do the squaring and we compute it, we see that, yes, in fact, they are equal. Because when you actually do this, you have, you know, minus pi x squared and plus pi x squared, they cancel, and we end up with just over here 2xr pi, 2xr pi on this side. They do balance. That one big disk from the cylinder balances with those two disks from the sphere and the cone. Okay? So this is just the algebra that proves that they balance. Now, once we have that, and of course, you know, you can't follow it just right, you have to do it yourself, but it shows that these things balance. The thing that we have pictured here balances. But look, if we just do all of them and put them together, then we balance the entire sphere at the point 2r, because we're always moving those disks to the 2r side. We balance the entire cone to that side, and then we're leaving the cylinder where it is, because each of its slices just stays where they are. And that would balance, you see, because every little piece balances, so the whole thing would balance. But now when we have two things that are balancing, we know what to do. We know that the volume of the left side times the distance away from the fulcrum is equal to the distance away from the fulcrum times the volume of the right side. But we know the volume of the right side, it's just a cylinder. Okay? So R, which is the center of the cylinder, it's as though you put that whole mass at the center of the cylinder, R times the volume of the cylinder. What's the volume of the cylinder? Well, I call it CYL. That's the volume of the cylinder. We know the formula for that. We'll get it later. But we see that the distance away with this weight is equal to the distance away, 2R, with the weight of the sphere plus the weight of the cone. So we know that these two things, since we proved that they're going to balance, then these things are true. But we know a lot of them. We know the formula for the volume of the cylinder, right? It's just the base times the height. It's pi times 2r squared times 2r, base times the height, and then we're multiplying it by r. So that's this side. And we know that that's equal to 2r times the volume of the sphere, which we don't know yet, plus 2r times the volume of the cone. But that's what we just did. We know the volume of a cone. The volume of a cone is 1/3 the area of the base, which is pi times 2r squared, 2r all squared, times its height, 2r. So we know the volume of a cone, we know the volume of a cylinder, we just do the algebra and compute that the volume of the sphere is 4/3 pi r cubed. So this is Archimedes' proof that the volume of the cylinder is 4/3 pi r cubed. And in fact, you can literally do this. Here's a picture of me where I made these things, but I've lost them. These are a cone, where you see its base is 2r, a sphere, radius r, and a cylinder. And I actually put them on a balance like this, and they balanced. Much, incidentally, to my surprise. So there we have it. It was a victory. They had literally is balancing like a teeter totter with this entire thing coming right up to the fulcrum, which is right here. And then these are 2r away, both the sphere and the cone are balanced at distance 2r. They balance. So that was the proof that the volume of the sphere is equal to 4/3 pi r cubed. So you really saw it in two ways. One was the surface area coning down to the center and adding up those things. That's called the Cavalieri principle, by the way, when you add all those up. That's another formula for the volume of the cylinder. And this is another formula that Archimedes did for the volume of a sphere being, I meant volume of sphere before, volume of sphere is 4/3 pi r cubed. So, good for Archimedes. Thank you very much.
This is like
a styrofoam. I mean, it's a spongy light material.
I just couldn't tell what that.
Yeah. It would be fun to actually make a good one, you know, out of like a metal or something. You know, that would be really cool. That would be cool, and you could actually do it. And so there's a hole in this one, so it balances, and also it's cool. This is actually my wife who made it, by the way. So just in, you know, truth in advertising here. So this is great. Now, by the way, I know perfectly well because I learned this years ago, and it required me to go through it many times, and I got stuck, and I'd have to do it again and again. There's no way you can just sit here and learn the proof of these things. You just can't do that. But what I'm hoping that I've done is to entice you enough about this and find it intriguing enough that you'll actually go home and figure out the details and actually find them and then explain them to somebody else, which is the time at which you'll actually understand it yourself. These are really fun enough things. Well, both the derivative of the sine, the integral of the sine, the surface area of the sphere. I mean, these are all very cool things, and it's worth putting in your bag of really, you know, fascinating mathematics, I think. And so that's why I wanted to show them to you, and I hope you enjoyed it. Any other questions? Thank you very much, Dustin. Thank you.
We have